Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your Cybertron of music news and criticism. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. And you're listening to Riyadh from the new record called Transport. Juan Atkins and Moritz von Oswald present Borderland, a new record on the Trezor record label, which one of our guests, Peter Orlov, has written about.
Hello,
Peter.
Hello.
We also have Mike Rubin with us.
Howdy.
All three of us, just recently, a week and a bit ago, were in Detroit at the Movement Festival and other things during Memorial Day weekend, where we saw those people. Juan Atkins and Moritz von Oswald.
Indeed we did.
Peter, your piece, which is running this week in the Times, is about, from a distance, it's about aging in techno, the idea of aging in techno.
Correct.
Specifically about the music on this record.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you explain the music on this record or describe it, and then what does it signify?
I would describe this album as a unique example of classic techno, which had its seeds in Detroit and Berlin, but created in a very contemporary fashion.
Mm-hmm. And we should say that these guys go back a long way.
They do.
Juan Atkins is old school Detroit techno.
Yes. I mean, he is arguably one of the first two, not arguably, he is one of the first two people in the lineage of Detroit techno. And Moritz von Oswald is one of the earliest producers to make techno music, internationally recognized techno music in Berlin.
Yeah.
Although he had been a musician for quite a few years beforehand.
Yeah. He was in Pali Schomburg. There's a great video on YouTube with him waving a flag. He's got flippy hair.
Mm-hmm.
But then the most famous for Basic Channel and then the Maurizio tracks that he did.
Yes, but also, and this got struck from the piece, but he was also a very major reggae head. And he and his partner in Basic Channel and Maurizio, Mark Ernestus, were dub producers under the name Rhythm and Sound.
Mm-hmm.
And that has in itself had a lot of impact on what the sound of Berlin dance music is. You asked about Transport, their new record. This is the second record that they've done together, Juan and Moritz. Their first record came out in, I believe, 2013. And that record sounded a lot like what Moritz's recent records have sounded like, which is a very, very wide base of electronic instrumentation, a lot of drum machines, a lot of almost vampy chords.
Mm-hmm.
That are going on. He calls them floaters. He likes to think about music as not being interactive, but almost horizontal in terms of how it works. He has a visual way to relate to the music
mm-hmm.
now. But Transport is a different matter entirely. It's a lot bassier. It's a lot dancier. It's a lot more engaging. And in that way, it almost seems more composed. Moritz called the first record jammy, although he instantly said that he didn't like that word. But this one is a lot more composed, a lot more speculative in terms of there's melodies going on everywhere. Its contemporaneousness comes through in the fact that it's crystal clear. It's a beautiful sounding
mm-hmm.
record. It's not lo-fi in the slightest. But what it also is it's deep. And I can't describe it any better than that, just in terms of its sound, in terms of the emotions that are coming off the record. And in that way, it harkens back to the best of Detroit techno for me.
Is it a marriage in any way between the sound of Detroit and the sound of Berlin?
I would say it absolutely is. I would say that it is a Berlin record made with Detroit in mind.
So we saw them play on, what was it, Saturday afternoon?
Saturday afternoon.
During the festival. Mm-hmm. And it was a sort of a quiet scene
yeah.
in that here are these two guys who were seated. They were in office chairs.
Mm-hmm.
They both had...
With dinner jackets on.
That's right. Did they have their techno scarves on?
Oh,
I think it was too hot for them.
Moritz had
a techno scarf.
Did he?
Yeah, like a turquoise techno scarf.
Yeah, he looks good in that. They both had laptops open. Moritz had a little keyboard. I'm not sure what all Juan Atkins had.
I think he had a little mixing board.
Mm-hmm.
And right behind them was the third member of their live trio, a gentleman by the name of Laurens von Oswald. Mm-hmm. He is Moritz's nephew,
uh-huh.
and he also helped engineer the record.
So it was about an hour or an hour and a bit. There are a couple breaks, maybe three or four, mm-hmm. you know. It was very even. The whole thing was so even. Not a ton of dynamics.
Mm-hmm. I think it was, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed to be more material from that first record they did, which was a little more static than the new one.
I would say yes. I would also say that its evenness was in the mix of the overall sound presentation.
Mm-hmm.
I could actually hear things being triggered that brought a lot of rhythmic dynamics to the fore. But it seemed like, even like walking around on the floor, the sound was very, very uneven.
Mm-hmm.
It was slight disappointment.
They were in the main bowl, the large concrete amphitheater at Hart Plaza in Movement, which is not acoustically a terrific space. And what they do, to me, Moritz has always felt, the music always felt sort of amniotic. It's very immersive. It's very great headphones music. It's great music if you're in a place with a terrific sound system.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not necessarily dance music. There's not. There's definitely no shtick to it. There's no drops and not a lot of skittering beats. It's just a sort of a pulse. I think years ago I thought it called it deep burble.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And in this particular case, you're talking about the music that he's been making in like the last 5-6 years.
Yeah.
As opposed to the basic channel and sort of that formative techno that he first became famous for.
Well, so it struck me all through the weekend that Movement Festival in Detroit is a place where you can go to learn like a crash course, something about the local history of techno, Detroit techno. A lot of the original guys are there playing sets, DJ sets mostly, not just Juan Atkins, but Kevin Saunderson and Carl Craig and
Derek May.
They've pretty much all played at some point in the festival's history. They've all done something.
And you guys have been writing about Detroit techno for a really long time. Here are these performers and DJs who are now well into their 40s and beyond. All through the weekend, it struck me like this is New Orleans. This is a heritage music. New things are happening in techno, but also this is a local cultural resource to protect and celebrate and so on. It's not happening in the ways that it is happening or has happened in New Orleans, at least yet. I mean, I can envision nonprofit preservationist organizations and museums and whatever. Has that happened yet?
There's a little. I mean, in the past 2 years, there's an organization called the Detroit Sound Conservancy that an academic in the Detroit area, Carlton Goles, has started, which was initially focused on trying to rescue the United Sound Studios, which was so many terrific records that but they're Motown or Parliament Funkadelic. So many records have been made over the years. I-94 was scheduled, an expansion was scheduled to go right through their studios. And mm-hmm. so they've been embroiled in that in the last couple of years. But through that, they founded an archival organization that's focused on trying to create a permanent record, because Detroit's not a place that there's been much permanent record. It's not a city with a strong written tradition the way that New York has, and it doesn't have the strong visual tradition that, say, Los Angeles has. There's just the music and the recordings, and then even there, it obviously things like that are ephemeral. Like Motown moved to Los Angeles from Detroit in 1974, which was in many ways that's an incredible rupture in the history of the city.
For sure.
I would also add that there are little pockets of documentation. The Detroit Library has a Detroit Techno exhibit.
One of the great things that's still ongoing, there's a space on Grand Boulevard just a mile or so down the road from where Motown used to be called Submerge. The store in the basement, which is usually appointment only, it's called Somewhere in Detroit, but the space is Submerged. It's an organization, distribution company that was set up originally by Underground Resistance, who are a Detroit area techno collective. And in the first floor of that space, I don't know if you got to go during your weekend.
No,
but
I didn't.
There's basically a techno museum.
Yeah.
There's a they think they originally called it Submerged 3000, but it's got everything from you know different drum machines that were used to
platinum record for Cybertron.
It's a terrific little space. It's open only by appointment only, except for that weekend. So during that the weekend of the Heritage Music of Movement Festival, you can fly in from Tokyo or Berlin and just go there. Otherwise, you need to do a little research and figure out how to book a tour.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a wonderful space. I brought someone who had never been there before, and this weekend he was really floored what's there.
Well, let's move from new Juan Atkins and Moritz von Oswald to something they did a while back, a track called Jazz is the Teacher. When is this from?
This is from 1992. It was the first time that Juan Atkins came to Berlin. It is a collaboration between Moritz Juan and a gentleman named Thomas Fellman, who also plays a big part in the story of the conversation between Detroit and Berlin.
And together they're called 3MB.
Three Men in Berlin.
Jazz is the Teacher. That's Jazz is the Teacher from 3MB from 1992. One of the things that I did over the weekend in my quest to create a museum of my own of techno is I went to a panel discussion with Derek May, Juan Atkins, and Kevin Saunderson. And you guys have probably seen this kind of thing happen a lot. Well, they all went to the same high school, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Belleville?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, it's a certain exurb of about halfway between Ann Arbor and Detroit.
So they're called the Belleville
Three.
The Belleville Three. Well, they knew each other. They worked with each other. They were starting around the same time, late 70s, early 80s.
I think Juan was just ahead of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And creating techno, basically. It's always amazing when the actual architects of a kind of music are still around and still making music. So I saw a panel discussion with them at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Detroit, and they went off on a tangent about futurism, how interested they were in ideas about the future in their youth. They talked about the Alvin Toffler book, Future Shock, which Derek May said was the worst thing that ever happened to him, reading that book, because it made him a cynic. It made him have no hope, or made him not believe in anything. It's very interesting. He said a lot of negative things, including the fact that his music sounds the way it does, or did sound the way it did, because he couldn't stand Detroit as a young person.
Yeah, you told me that, and I found that to be a little surprising, because I hadn't heard that before.
I think what he was talking about was, I love it and I hate it, that kind of thing.
I can sympathize.
I'm disappointed. I'm angry. This is my city, but look at the state it's in, that kind of thing.
It's a complicated city with a complicated history.
Yeah.
And part of it is because so much there's so much scorn heaped on it from outside that those who are from it tend to be very defensive. But at the same time, they look around and they're very critical. So it's how and when they express their criticisms is the issue. It's that you can, you know, within the house, you can make the criticism, but when you hear about it from someplace, somebody quote unquote parachuting in from out of town, it's a different issue.
So they were talking about futurism in a philosophical way, and it made me think about how, you know, whether futurism, which techno, I mean, in some part is founded on that idea, whether that's at odds with its present state of becoming a historical thing, as we were saying before, a heritage music. Is there a paradox there?
I don't look at it in exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are basic sounds and basic pre-programming bits on a keyboard or on a drum machine that signify techno. But I guess just like jazz, you know, you invoke New Orleans and saying, well, the moment that Dixieland or the music of Louis Armstrong stop being played that way, does that mean jazz ended and jazz became a heritage music? Probably the argument would be that it has not. What happened in that birth moment is a set of instructions. And I like to think of what happened in Detroit Techno, as a set of rules and a set of instructions mm-hmm. that can be followed in different places by different people. And so when I listen to Detroit, you know, there are things you listen to even current Detroit records and you're like, okay, that's a Detroit record, or that's a record that's been influenced by Detroit because of certain sounds, certain techniques. But it's also just as interesting to me to hear techno made in other places where you can absolutely hear the location be an effect
right.
of that techno. I mean, right now, as I'm saying this, I'm thinking about Japan. There's a lot of incredible ambient psychedelic techno being made in Japan right now. And it doesn't sound like Detroit. It sounds like it's influenced by Detroit. There are lessons to have been learned there. But it is completely, completely different. Or things that are in London that are influenced by the London scene. Or back to our original example, Berlin. There's a lot of overlap between Berlin and Detroit. But generally speaking, Berlin is a lot harder. It's a lot dubbier.
Well, I mean, I think there is a paradox in some ways because originally these were young African-American musicians who were using what they had available to them, which was using drum machines. And I don't want to go too deep into the story of the Roland. They ended up with using something that was supposed to be for a bass sound. They ended up finding creating the roots of house and techno from this. It was a very lo-fi that's, 35 to 38 years ago. Mm-hmm. Since then, They've been able to acquire other equipment.
Yeah.
There's still a certain fetishism for those original sounds. Not necessarily in Detroit, but all over. There's a certain kind of way that people, I know musicians who seek out that vintage gear. I mean, they say they want that particular kind of sound that they got from something that was an old, crappy, affordable thing that you could have you could purchase with very little money at the time. It was futuristic, but it was also very pragmatic and practical.
So what Mike is talking about right now is actually the thing that I do feel like it falls into a heritage box, which is the fetishization of analog.
Yeah.
On the one hand, I have a turntable, I play records, I love warmer sounding records, but to me, it is the music that is made rather than the gear. And sometimes those two things are really, really hard to pull apart from one another. But I think that there is a lot of people putting themselves into this box, trying to create, a classic sounding thing using the classic gear, but making just like more modern carbon copies.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that makes Transport stand out, and those guys are like, they're both studio rats, but at the same time they're also completely, completely aware with all the modern technologies. Mm-hmm. And I said, any analog gear on this record? And they didn't say no, but they definitely said a lot of patch-ins, a lot. It was all software.
But one of the things that earmarks Detroit, and then in some ways, the music from Berlin that's inspired by Detroit, there's a real emphasis with the Detroit music on having a soulful edge to it. I mean, Derek May helped produce a documentary that was called High Tech Soul some years ago. It's about the conversation between African-American musicians using Japanese equipment influenced by Germans like Kraftwerk,
right.
and then bringing back to the Parliament Funkadelic they grew up listening to. So there's a constant interaction there. That funk, that percussive element that's there in the best of the Detroit musics, as it moved out to the world, that became bleached is a complicated word, but mm-hmm. The story of these were African Americans got lost. Part of it was part of the way the industry works. Part of it was the fact they used a lot of pseudonyms that were rather anonymous. But what ended up happening was that the music that came back from Europe back to America was made almost exclusively by white Europeans
yeah.
and then white performers. So the knowledge of that Black Roots and some of the sound of the Black Roots was lost. I mean, you ended up with the music of Detroit can be played at a rave, but the rave experience was a much more...
It was a very monochromatic experience.
Yeah, it was a much... Yeah.
And I would agree with Mike about that wholeheartedly. This conversation about globalization from the perspective of these young African-American men in Detroit at a time when communication was a minuscule amount of what it is right now. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have to actually seek these things out. You have to seek out these ideas. They made those ideas, to me, when I was first listening to this music, so much more powerful. You know, going to Detroit for the first time in the early aughts to find this place, to see that these were men on the street. Moritz and Dimitri spoke about how, you know, going there and seeing around every corner these people who were making some of the greatest music that they had ever heard, and here they were on the street.
Yeah, so much of the initial success of that Detroit Electronic Music Festival, which evolved into Movement, was the fact that these musicians were getting to play in front of audiences and in front of their families sometimes, or colleagues or close friends, for the first time. When at that point there were virtually no club spaces available to play in Detroit. I did a story in 97 or 98 in which the very first club that was playing techno was actually opening, because so many of the parties originally had been at warehouses, and there was just the Music Institute was the one space in the late 80s that was very short-lived. And since then, there had been nowhere for these guys to perform, whether it was playing live or spinning records in their hometown. They were in Detroit from, say, Tuesday through Thursday, and they'd live and they'd create music, and then they were off to Amsterdam or Tokyo or Paris on the weekends. They're building up frequent flyer miles, but they weren't able to play to their peeps.
When Mike and I first met, now a long time ago, we really laughed at the fact that these people weren't even playing in New York. Because when they would get booked in New York, so few people would show up. We used to call it the Detroit curse.
The curse of Detroit, yeah. There was originally, I talked to Carl Craig for this story back in 97 or 98, and he told me he was trying, because the connection had been lost between generations, between his generation of African-American music aficionados in Detroit and young kids who are now into hip-hop. He had an idea to pass out free cassettes of what techno was to kids at school so that they could hear that, no, this was music that had been created and made by African Americans, and it wasn't this white, quote unquote, white music that was coming back. And so that was his original impetus with the Detroit Electronic Music Festival. And so when that was launched in 2000, it was this very emotional moment where a lot of people got to play for their friends, for their families. They got to see, you know, it was this huge outpouring.
300,000 people in Hart Plaza by some estimates.
Yeah.
Then one interesting element of the early days of Detroit techno is this guy, Rick Davis, who has not been in the public eye for quite a while, right?
He's been definitely out of the recording sphere for at least the last 20 years.
Right. You, Mike Rubin, wrote an amazing article about Rick
Thank
Davis,
you.
Spelled R-I-K Davis, in a recent issue of The Note, published by Red Bull Music Academy, in which you track down Rick Davis. Rick Davis was a member of Cybertron with Juan Atkins. His name came up at the panel discussion I was at, a colorful person. They all sort of nodded and smiled and described him as a colorful person. What's the deal with Rick Davis? What was his contribution?
He was one of the first synthesizer enthusiasts almost in America. I mean, he came back from Vietnam in 69. He's old enough to have served in that war, and from 68 and 69 he came back, and he was inspired by Rick Wakeman and Emerson, Lake and Palmer. Anything that seemed progressive and anything using synthesizers, he'd go to Detroit record stores and try to find Isao Tomita records or Larry Fast records. Didn't have much luck, but anything that had a synthesizer, there was a track, he told me, a Steve Miller Band track, I think Electrolux Imbroglio on Book of Dreams, just a couple-minute instrumental, but that to him was just pure bliss. Mm-hmm. And so these were the sounds that he was into, and he went out and bought an Arp Ax synthesizer that was affordable at the time, and he made his first recording in 1978 called Methane Sea, which he released himself, which was just out of nowhere. I mean, there's nothing happening in Detroit along those lines.
Yeah.
And that track ended up being used as theme music for the nightly radio show of the Electrifying Mojo, who was a very influential Detroit area FM radio DJ who was the one that really introduced Kraftwerk and the idea of this sort of of not having firm divisions between races in terms of music, what he called the apartheid of the dial. He was about breaking that down and playing Kraftwerk to an African-American audience and playing Peter Frampton of the Rolling Stones at the same time, B-52s. And Rick then later it met Juan Atkins. They were taking classes at Washtenaw County Community College and taking a music class, and they were both shared this affinity for synthesizers, and so they ended up creating this project called Cybotron.
Right.
Their first record came out in 1981, and I remember I went out and bought it based on hearing it. I was an early teen and just buying it off of the hearing it off the radio when Mojo would play it.
Yeah,
on Fantasy Records, which
that's
I think,
right.
That's later. Later comes 81. Is 81? Okay. They put out two singles.
Oh, you're talking about the singles. Yes.
Yeah, they put out two singles themselves, and they sold about 15,000 copies of these self-pressed records in Detroit, which got the attention of Fantasy, who then signed them to a deal, and that they ended up putting out their album Enter in 1983, of which the big hit from that, the one that was sort of the transforming thing for the scene, was a song called Clear.
And one of the side notes in your article is that Rick Davis himself did not like Kraftwerk.
He said, I think he said there were sometimes it was mindless beats. He found some of what they did frivolous and vain.
Yeah, he's into a more humanistic thing. He prefers Ultravox.
Ultravox. He's all about music that stirs the soul, but also inspires the self to action. For him, Rage in Eden was a huge influential record. I remember Juan telling me some years ago when I interviewed him about how important Ultravox was to him as well. But it definitely, you can see with their two sounds how they veer off in that point.
Well, to get back to this topic one more time, and I don't want to feel like I'm forcing it, about futurism. When you look at the work of young African-American musical creators back then, late 70s, early 80s in Detroit, people like Rick Davis and people like Derek May, do you get the sense that the way Rick Davis loved that sound on that Steve Miller Band record or whatever, that they were going after sounds, tones that suggested another reality, another world, a world better than the one they were living in?
Yeah, I mean, again, to differing degrees depending on the individual. I
know who we're talking about. Sure.
Yeah, Rick was hugely influenced, he said, by that sort of the psychedelic transitional scene in 2001, A Space Odyssey, with the long scene with all the Douglas Trumbull's special effects.
Yeah.
And that was something he was trying to capture musically, and then later in music and his own video work.
Right.
Whereas Juan came really from a more dance party background.
Right.
But he was the one that brought in the Alvin Toffler future shock element, and Derek May is a very verbose and good at articulating theoretical concepts, and there was a lot of the talked about futurism there. But
anyway, I just think it's interesting that you go from an idea of let's escape this world to almost 40 years later, the idea of, no, let's preserve the world that we have. Let's find the historical continuities. Let's cultivate it. Let's protect it. I'm talking about musical culture,
right?
African-American musical culture. In new techno, do you find people who have some of that original techno spirit of let's create something that sounds completely other? Or do you find more of let's return to classic techno?
It's not an either or.
And it never is. Yeah. I mean, I understand that.
I would say that there is now, it's not a genre, but it's definitely a post-techno sound that is being made for the clubs in the gender fluid community.
Mm-hmm.
Folks like Alicia Crampton and Rabbit. They are creating a sound of something different.
Yeah, sure.
There's that kind of thing.
I agree with you. Those records make you feel like you're in another place.
Well, there's a visceral and often negative reaction that is coming from the traditional techno community to those records. And what it makes me think of is that people think of the club as only a place to dance. They don't think of the club as being an exalted sonic experience, mm-hmm. because those records don't sound the same way at home as they do in a club with a great sound system, and that's where they really, really need to play, mm-hmm. or they need to be heard for the full effect, even if that effect does not make you dance. The other thing that I would say, go back to my point about creating a set of rules, is this idea that you can create a progressive electronic techno-like music with a lot of different folk musics. And that, to me, is a thing that is very, very exciting. I mean, you know, I've been listening to a lot of cumbia over the last decade, and the kind of cumbia that I really, really enjoy hearing is made with a lot of drum machines and keyboards and samples, mm-hmm. techno raga mm-hmm. from Colombia and things like that. A lot of ZZK label out of Buenos Aires. They're by no means an other in terms of creating a different reality, but they are bringing something different and new to the reality in existence.
Sure. Well, and it is possible to find the future in the past.
Yeah, I mean, that's what folk stories are all about, right?
It could be. Mike Rubin, what do you think?
It gets complicated because I definitely feel there's certain sounds I love and I respond to almost autonomically, but at the same time I don't like something that's too hidebound by trying to sound like a particular thing.
Right.
You know, I can think of the things I think of in that guy are jazz records. I think of, like, when I think of Courtney Pine or something, it was people that were trying to sound so deliberately like Coltrane, but something had gotten lost in the translation. Mm-hmm. There's some of that with techno. I mean, I shouldn't mention any artists, but there's people I can think of that are both in Detroit and definitely some Europeans that are definitely hewing to what that early Detroit sound and that is, and that stuff is much less interesting to me than the original recordings or the people that are taking those original recordings and have been influenced by them but are bringing their own day-to-day yeah. experiences. And there's a lot of interesting young artists who've come from Detroit in the last couple of years. Kyle Hall, Jay Daniel.
Manuel Gonzalez.
Yeah. There's been a lot of, in some ways, the most exciting genre to be coming from Detroit in the last few years is Detroit House, which borrows from Chicago house sounds and New York disco, but also brings in an understanding of Detroit techno and also what happens in a Detroit party. So, and
well, that's one of the things that we haven't really talked about is the Detroit style of DJing,
yeah.
Which is such a major part of this conversation, because really it's not just the records that you make, it's how you play them.
Yeah.
And the way that some people play them in Detroit, people like, you know, we all just saw Claude Young that you wrote about in the movement piece.
And he's coming to New York this weekend,
he's
right?
He's in New York on Friday.
Apparently a 5-hour Claude Young set for those who can figure out where it's going
to
happen.
Rumored to be. Go yeah. look on Resident Advisor, send an email, and they will tell you where it's at.
Yeah, there's definitely a distinct way of spinning that comes out of a Detroit tradition. And there's, of course, people like Claude Young who are old school and are now beginning to gig again in America. But there's an entire school of younger DJs or their 20s to their 30s who grew up in Detroit that were known mainly for playing in Detroit parties who are now getting international play. There's Derek Blaslako and Mike Servito and Patrick Russell and Carlos Souffrant and BMG, Brendan Gillen, who are... Mm-hmm. Who had mostly played in Detroit until they moved to New York or moved to Berlin and are now regulars at the Bunker Party in New York. Most of them had not made their own records. A few of them are now beginning to put out their own records or do their own remixes. Mm-hmm. But they're now getting lots of attention from Resident Advisor and some of the sort of European techno tastemaker scenes.
Yeah.
So.
Well, so to close out, we will go way, way back to Cybotron, the group with Rick Davis and Juan Atkins, and we'll hear the track Clear. And I want to thank you, Peter Orlov, and you, Mike Rubin, for coming today.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
That's our show, and thank you for listening. You can read Peter Orlov's piece on Juan Atkins and Moritz von Oswald Present Borderland at nytimes.com/music. You can read Mike Rubin's piece on Rick Davis at The Note, which is at daily.redbullmusicacademy.com. Our producers are Pedro Rosado and Jocelyn Gonzalez. You can listen to some of the music that we've been talking about on our Spotify playlist, and we'll see you next week.